because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Happy New Year, Coach. Whether you're an old or new fan, thanks for supporting the Basketball Podcast. We look forward to a great 2020. One coach emailed me over the holidays, told me, Coach, we have more wins already than all of last year. Even better, they're against teams we have never beat in the past. All thanks to full basketball immersion, as I like to say. Simply put, basketball immersion has made new to basketball girls into really good basketball players. We have been playing some beautiful basketball, which is crazy to think back in March when I was trying to guess where on the schedule we could get a win. Thanks for all you do in sharing the game. Well, I'm grateful for Coach for sharing that, and I look forward to some great success for all of you in 2020. Enjoy the podcast. Coach, is awesome today to have Lisa Tomitis with us. Lisa is the head coach of the women's national basketball team in Canada and is also the head coach of the University of Saskatchewan Huskies. And Coach, first, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Chris, for having me on.
Our history goes back a long way, and I was just talking to you a little bit briefly about, I couldn't believe you've been there for 22 years now as the head coach of the University of Saskatchewan. Tremendous success. I mean, you've been multiple times National Coach of the Year. You've won a national championship and just tremendous consistency in terms of running a college program. I think, what is it, eight of the last 10 years you've been at Nationals, or is it?
Oh, yeah, I'm not too sure. I think it might be a couple more. It might be 10.
No, 10 of the last 11. Yeah, 10 of the last 11. Yeah, which is incredible. I mean, incredible success. And full disclosure for people, Lisa and I go back to our early years together in Hamilton, where she started her coaching career and I did as well. So a lot of fun we're going to have talking basketball today.
Absolutely.
And Coach, congrats. The women's national team, as you go into this qualification round, is now ranked fourth in the world, and that's a program high.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about that. I mean, you know, we've seen this consistent ascent up the world rankings, and most recently, yeah, now fourth in the world, and having qualified now for the Olympic qualifier, we're heading to Belgium in February. So we're really excited about that and the opportunities that are ahead of us over the next year.
Well, we're not going to talk much about that process of qualification because it's beyond the scope of this podcast, but I'm so happy you guys are moving along and all the success you've had with the national program as well. So
Coach,
one of the things that came out is when I heard you speak at the Best in the West Clinic in Saskatchewan, you talked about team identity. Can you share with us the words that you use in terms of defining team identity?
Yeah, you know, we've spent a lot of time working on this over the past year, I'd say, and we came up with our three words are dynamic, relentless, and together. And, you know, it's easy to kind of come up with the words and it's clearly a different animal to now live them. And so essentially what we're trying to do is make sure that those words permeate everything that we do and how we do things, how we play, how we operate, you know, how our players express themselves on the court, what our team looks like when we do play together. And then also it extends to our staff and our coaching staff and, you know, how are we being dynamic in our preparation, in our ability to coach our players on the floor and prepare. So yeah, that's been a great process for us. And I think it really bonds what we're doing around those three words. So it's been fun going through this.
Well, it's great because it's not just words, and we're going to get into how you tie it into so many things that you do with the program. But just quickly, what's the advantage of having an identity?
Yeah, again, it's always something that you can look back upon. You know, you can evaluate your performance and really have a look. And did we live these words today? Did we live our identity? And if we didn't, you know, where were the shortcomings and where were the gaps? And if we did, what did it look like? What did it feel like? What did it sound like? And so you always have that grounding to come back to that really brings us, I think it really provides clarity. And that's probably the most important piece with those identity words and pieces.
Well, imagine the other part with the national program in particular is that your roster is never consistent from event to event. So is this another thing that helps tie in players to the program, whether they're there or not there, I imagine?
It does. And again, going through this process, a big part of it was, you know, acknowledging the style of play and I guess the team identity that brought us to where we are now, and what the type of players and the style of play that brought us to where we are. And now how are we going to take some of those things and continue to catapult us moving forward? So it really is a bit of a paying them respect to what brought us to where we are. And now how can we continue to grasp onto those pieces and now build upon them to continue to take us forward? And like you said, we're constantly bringing in different athletes. People are coming in for one phase and maybe not there for another, and then coming in for a later one. And so, like you said, having those, that style of play that's consistent, that our athletes know what's expected and the style that we do need to express ourselves with, I think it's really helpful.
Can you choose one of the words, maybe dynamic, relentless, together, one of them, and just give us a feel for what, how that word describes, say, what a practice would look like if you're being dynamic, relentless, or together?
Yeah. I mean, the dynamic piece, I think the one that probably comes to mind is probably speed and athleticism. And again, just expressing our athletic ability out there on the court, but at the same time, also being ever changing and able to, again, maybe in our preparation for teams, being able to play a certain way against one team, but then also being adaptable. So being dynamic that way and changing how we play a little bit to take advantages or take an advantage that we believe we have on another opponent. Or being adaptable as far as an individual player. So you're playing kind of one way against one team and then have to be able to do something a little bit different against someone else. So yeah, we want to be ever changing. We want to be high tempo. We want to be athletic. And that's a bit of the dynamic piece for sure. And then again, with coaches, how can we adapt on the fly and be, again, just be very dynamic and not to be set in our ways, but to take a chance, to make some changes, to be the aggressor. Those would all kind of be descriptors of what our dynamic would look like.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And you mentioned playing with a faster pace, and this has been a philosophy change over the years with you with the national program, where you used to run a little bit more Princeton style stuff and now more emphasis on pace. Can you talk about a little bit of that change?
Yeah. Allison McNeil, who's a former head coach and a mentor of mine, she made the decision back in, I think, 2010 to bring in Princeton. And it was a brilliant move, really. And we stuck with Princeton, and it brought us a ton of success. And we utilized it through 2012 Olympics in London and stuck with it through to the 2016 Rio Olympics. And yeah, it was great because I think it really took advantage of the athletes and the basketball IQ that we did have on the team at the time. Played a very smart brand of basketball, maybe not with the most pace. What we did get was we got high shot quality. We moved the ball. We had some players who could really pass the ball. It opened up the rim for our perimeter players to be able to attack. It took some traditional big bigs that we'd have to play against and pulled them away from the basket so that we could attack with some of our athleticism at the five position. And it really brought us a lot of success. But what we found is as our roster was somewhat transitioning and we didn't have as much time to spend together as a team. And that was a big advantage of our national team program leading into 2016, was that we had a ton of time together and we were able to, you know, adopt the Princeton offense and you know, make modifications certainly, but it requires a lot of time together. You really have to have a lot of synergy to be able to execute that system flawlessly and to a very high level. And we simply, after 2016, weren't going to have that time. We have more and more players now in the WNBA, which means that we don't have summers to spend together. We don't have long training camps to get systems like this in place. So we decided to move away from it. And again, to really think about exploiting some of our athleticism and the athletes that we were going to have in the mix and play at a faster pace. So we've moved away from it. And again, it seems to have worked for us right now. We are fourth in the world, but we, you know, ultimately need to get on that podium. And so now what we're looking for is just, you know, those one percenters, those little bits that can then help us, you know, get over the next hump and to get on that podium. And so that's a process that we've been going through over the last few years since Rio.
Well, it's a great example of a successful program. This wasn't developed out of panic or anything like that. A successful program making a change during success to try and get to that next level. I think there's so many coaches that can relate to that. So it's such a great example of that.
Yeah, thanks.
With these identities, the question then for me is, do you recruit a little bit to the identity? Is that now something that's helped you for athlete identification as well, whether it be in the development teams or within the senior national team as well?
I'm not sure we go that far. I think, again, we're fairly in the infancy stage of this identity process and development. So we're probably less than a year into this. So as it kind of filters down, and I think once it gets through the age group and it starts permeating through some of the younger teams, I think it could potentially get to that. I think the cool thing about some of the identity pieces is it reflects who we are as Canadians as well. So I think the relentless piece really speaks to Canadiana and who we are as Canadian athletes and again, how we play and how we see success on the sporting stage. So yeah, I think eventually, like you said, it could get to a point where you recruit that way. I think for a lot of our athletes who get to the stage where they're senior national team prospects, they possess a lot of these pieces already. And now the magic comes with how you take that and how you make that your team identity and how you mold these individuals into that identity that we want to see, that we believe is going to produce a medal-worthy standard and performance.
What I like is obviously you reinforce these identities through discussion and video and specific drills, et cetera. But we're going to talk about some of those specific things. And one of the things that I liked when I heard you talk about this was how you connect this to scout. Can you talk about how the team identity words relate to your scouts?
Yeah. So again, fairly new and have brought it into our scouts. So it's really prevalent in everything that we do. Like you said, it's in video. We highlight when we see things in practice that exemplify relentless or dynamic or together to really reinforce it. It's always there. We're living it. And then in scout, yeah. So at the top of our scout, we have our three identity pieces and how those relate to the scouting process or to the preparation process in regards to the opponent that we have. So dynamic could be, you know what, we want to take advantage of our dynamic bigs, getting out, running front rim, let's get some early touches inside to them. Relentless could relate to our rebounding effort, dominating the glass and being relentless in our effort on the glass. And together, again, just ball movement, shot quality. So again, you always have those anchors that you can come back to and relate with the scout and with the preparation, which we found to be quite successful, or I shouldn't say successful because we can't specifically relate it to success, but we have received good feedback from the athletes that it helps with how it resonates with them and being able to connect the dots there.
Very cool. And it leads into a little bit more in-depth discussion of some of the scout stuff that you do. Can you talk specifically about how you approach scout in the moments before the game or the day of the game? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. We've kind of gone full circle. This is probably one of the areas that we've spent the most time on in terms of refining and getting to a final product in terms of our process and some of our systems. So day of, we'll typically meet. One of our foundational pieces is that we don't meet for longer than 30 minutes. And included in that 30 minutes is going to be an energizer just to get our players engaged in the process and more than anything, putting a smile on their face at the beginning of a meeting. So we get them engaged and then we have our scout meeting. Whatever coach is responsible for that scout, well, I'll first frame the game. So we'll talk about, you know, relative importance, you know, maybe traditional rival or traditional opponent, how the success that we've had with them in the past, maybe some significant games against them to kind of frame where we're coming from. And then whatever coach is responsible for that scout will get up and go through some of our video pieces. Our players will all receive the video or the film ahead of time. So they'll get it the night before. There'll be a main video piece that again is less than 10 minutes long. And then there'll be a supplemental video. So there's some athletes that really want a lot of information on their opponent and potential matchup. And there's others that really just want the necessities, right? Like, you know, what are the key actions that we're going to be facing tomorrow? And what do I need to know? Maybe some key defensive things that this team does that are unique. So those will be included in the main video. And then there's that supplemental video. So the expectation when players arrive at that meeting game day is that they've watched the video and they have a level of understanding and familiarity with what they're going to see. Because what we don't want to do is play the video and talk through it and essentially it just be a repeat of what they've already done. We're dealing with professional athletes here who have such a great understanding of the game and systems that they've seen these things a million times already. So a lot of times it's really just pointing out what is unique or what is different or special to this team that we have to be particularly aware of. So really trying to keep it fresh and dynamic and not being a boring meeting for them. And then the paper scout, again, is also given out in advance. And as I said, at the top will be our three identity pieces and really the keys to the game and how they relate to those identity pieces. And, you know, then we'll kind of have the typical player personnel. And we've really come to the conclusion that more is less, or less is more, I guess. So less information and not bogging down their minds with every little piece of info that we know about a specific athlete, but really what is the one, maybe two things that are unique just to this athlete that we need to be aware of. And not, again, overloading with information. And then probably the last piece is going to be around, and this is where we're really trying to balance more of the information, is around, you know, what are we going to do against this team? And not necessarily focus so much about, oh my gosh, what are they going to do and how are we going to react? But what are we going to do to exploit our advantages? And what's that going to look like in terms of systems that we may want to run or adaptations to current systems that we already have in place? So that's the area where we're probably still a work in progress. We're trying to make that more of a 50-50 split. I think in the past, I would have spent more like 95% on the opponent, maybe 5% on us. And now we're really trying to go the opposite way, move the needle more to a 50-50. So that's kind of what ours looks like. And then, of course, we go to the gym and we have our shoot and quote unquote walkthrough. So fairly typical that way.
Yeah, it's hopefully people that listen consistently to this podcast get this common theme from so many coaches like yourself that are saying, look, don't waste time on scout and telling players what they should already know and they should already be doing based on what you do throughout your whole development. And that's say, well, we don't have to tell them they should rebound, right?
Right.
Well, of course we should rebound. Of course we should play hard. Those things don't need to be on scout, and focus your players on the things that will actually help impact them in that game, which I love. And you phrase that so well. So that's wonderful stuff to be able to share. Players, I assume, have had pretty good buy-in and pretty good feedback on this.
Yeah, they have. And that's where it's been a work in progress, is really trying to solicit their feedback. You know, how does this work? How did you feel going into the game? Did you feel prepared? Did you have too much information? Not enough? And at one point, we were at a stage where we only had three players on the scout. We were really going the minimalistic route where, again, we just wanted to say, these are the three most important players on the other team, and this is what they're going to do. And this is how we're preparing for it. And the feedback was that, no, you know what? And I guess the philosophy behind that, or the premise behind only including three, was just, let's not cloud their brains with too much info. But what we found is that, again, they're so experienced. They're used to preparing for a number of opponents. But what they really want is, they want to know what that one person's go-to move is. And they want to see it on film. They want to have that visual. They want to be able to access some imagery around what they're going to expect the next day. So we've gone from, you know, the smallest number of three, and now we're back up to including, I think, 8 to 10 people on the scout. Again, very minimal information about each one of those 8 to 10, but at least they appear on the scout. And that's probably one thing that we have really gone from one extreme to the other.
Well, I love that you've tried that. I certainly have messed around with scout in my time and think so much of it is a time waster for coaches and players. So I love that you've even tried that to get the three players on the scout.
Yeah.
Team meeting. So you talked about that a little bit in terms of this is a team meeting for you guys, but just in general team meetings, you talked about energizers, and this is something that I've consistently seen through and that I believe our women's national team do a great job with. Can you talk a little bit about some examples of energizers that you use? And it's not just team meetings, right? You use these at the beginning of practice sometimes too.
Yeah, I mean, full credit to our mental performance consultant, Bryce Tully. He's really the one that has introduced this to us, and then we've incorporated over the last couple of years, and again, received some great feedback from the athletes around this. But yeah, like any game that encourages some connectivity, some interaction, some sharing of information. Our famous one, I guess, and most common one is Bing Bang Bong. We've committed to playing Bing Bang Bong in every country that we ever travel to. So players know that that's going to be coming up at some point, but it's literally just a fun game, 5 minutes, and usually gets them up out of their seat. So there's an element of just being active and up and alert. and engagement, right? They're all talking, they're moving, they're laughing. There's a level of competition. I mean, for some groups, when you have an energizer, you know, you kind of anticipate, okay, it'll be a fun game. When you do it with national team athletes, the level of competition that comes out of a silly little game is fun to watch. It's pretty impressive to see the competitive fires come out when you're playing something like that. But yeah, literally just a short one. And then we get right into the meeting after that and keeping all those meetings to under 30 minutes. And I think, again, just a level of respect for the athletes and their time and their ability to anticipate what they're coming into. So now they know, oh my goodness, this is going to be 30 minutes. I can stay focused. I can stay engaged for that amount of time. They're not coming in not knowing, is this going to be an hour long meeting? Is this going to be 10 minutes? Like, what is it? You know, I think sometimes there's a little bit of dread when there's that unknown, but hopefully for our athletes, they're now coming in with a bit of a fresh mindset, knowing that we're sticking to that. And that's just one of our premises.
To save coaches from Googling, bing, oh, gosh. Bing, bong, bang, can you just quickly describe it?
Yeah, you just kind of go around in a circle and how would I describe it? I'm not great at describing these because half the time I'm just killing myself laughing, but it's basically just a word game and you can't mess up and you can't, you know, flub a word and you can't go out of order. And if you do, then you're out. So it's fun.
It's fun. And just as a note, like when I was in New Zealand, I got a chance to watch Guy Malloy's team practice with the New Zealand women's national team.
Ah, great.
And they did a lot of on-court energizers in terms of keepaways and different types of games like that. And then the New Zealand Breakers, the NBL team, the men's side, they have I believe it's the performance coach that used to work with the rugby program in the country. And yes, he did a lot of stuff as energizers where he had a tennis racket and he was hitting different sized balls at players.
Okay.
And they had to catch them. And if it was this game, maybe you drop it or if you trap it in a certain way, then you're out and you go to another end. And yeah, it was just really cool, creative stuff. And it's really cool to see that at those levels.
Yes. I mean, really at the foundation of it, it's about having fun. Hey, and the more you can include that and incorporate that into anything that you're doing, our on-court stuff and our warm-up guru is our athletic therapist, Danielle Dobney. And I mean, she's world-class in what she does. And she's constantly thinking of these games as well that not only incorporate fun and activity and warm-up, but also basketball skills and things that are, you know, she'll listen into what we're talking about as coaches. You know, maybe we're having some frustrations with a certain part of the game and she'll incorporate that into warm-up and then make it a fun game and then make it interactive. So it's just really talking about and integrating all areas of our staff and our IST into what we're doing and how we're preparing, which I think we've really come a long way with over the last few years.
So these energizers engage the athlete in terms of, you know, their mindset for what's coming next. What are some other things that you do within the body of practice or meetings to engage athletes? Are there Q&As? Are there different types of, you know, stimulation in other ways? What are some things that you found best practices to engage these athletes?
Yeah, I think it's Q&As. I think it's exactly that. It's engaging them and you engage them by asking them. So our staff, I think, really is very collaborative. We're always wanting to get feedback from the athletes. We want to hear from them. We debrief practices and we want to hear from them. You know, how did that go? Are we making progress in the areas that we've talked about? When we're coming into practice, you know, we have certain goals set out or objectives that we're trying to reach. And did we do those? Did we accomplish that? So I think just the biggest piece is just engaging them and engaging them in the process. And when you can do that, again, they become more invested and the whole process just is that much more rewarding, I find. You don't want to hear after the fact about their great ideas. You know, like once the phase is done or the competitive tournament is done and then you find out weeks later, oh, hey, this could have been so much better. Or had we just done this, this would have been great. You know, I really want to along the way hear from them so that we can be dynamic, that we can adapt, that we can change and go with the flow a little bit. I try not to be so rigid that we can't do that. You know, we certainly have a plan in place, but love to be able to hear some of their needs and how we can best address them. So yeah, a lot of questioning and putting it out to them.
Since you brought up staff, the people around the program, you've talked about the integrated support team. You've alluded to them already, but you've also talked about the strength comes from the diversity of the staff. I get a lot of questions about staffing and how to engage staff. Can you share some best practices insights that you've found?
Yeah. Again, my default, I guess, is to really respect the professionals that we do have on staff and to know that they are experts in their area. So I really like to let them lead the way in their pillar. And I can't pretend to know more about mental skills than our mental performance coach, or to know more about strength and conditioning than our sports scientist. So really handing over a lot of autonomy to them to take their pillars and to run with it. But the most important factor, I think, is just the constant communication and the sharing of ideas. And they've been great with, they run things by me and tell me why they think it's important. And then, you know, I love hearing their ideas. They're really on the cutting edge of what's going on out there. So it's the constant communication. It's the dialogue between one another. And then it's the dialogue within. So not just from strength coach to coach, but also strength coach to mental performance consultant, to athletic therapist, to physiotherapist, so that we're all on the same page with what our goals and intentions are with this phase or this competitive portion of the schedule.
And this process of embedding is also something that comes through in everything that you've said so far, is that they're not separate, they're a part of. And I think that's such a part that people miss with the integration of staffs, that they're embedded. So let's bring out this example, because you've talked about this, about carrying a theme or something you want to emphasize across all facets of the program. So I think the example you shared was communication. So the therapist, I assume mental skills coach, et cetera, but everyone within practice, all the different phases you go through in a day, that is that something that's carried? That's a theme?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the goal. I don't know if we achieve it all the time, but certainly that is the goal. So we will have staff meetings and talk about that each day. We'll debrief it in the evening. But yeah, different people then are present at the, we'll have a pre-practice technical meeting. So not all of the staff will be present for that. It's one of the mistakes I've made in the past is not sharing all that information with, say, our physiotherapist or athletic therapist, not sharing with them what's going to go on in the technical meeting before practice. So when they don't know what the goal is of the upcoming training session, sometimes they're a little bit left in the dark and can't help when maybe athletes have questions or don't quite understand why we're doing things a certain way. So the more we can share with them what the goal is, then they can really reinforce around the edges. I think the physiotherapists are the ones that probably spend the most time with the athletes during some downtime and away from practice. And so they can really help and support in some of the messaging and the goal setting that we're doing as a staff. So again, it's, we've learned some lessons along the way, but the more that you can just share that information and have everyone on board, I think it really then becomes a strong cohesive unit and everyone feels invested in the process and able to help and assist in any way they can.
What have you discovered? Because I know you've played around with this with the different people associated with the program as well, but with pregame warmup, on-court pregame warmup, what are some things that you've found or some things that you've liked from around the world that you've seen as well?
Yeah, that's another one we've spent a lot of time working on. So a big one's going to be like heart rate response. So making sure we're mimicking and getting the body and the heart rate response relative to what they're going to experience in a game and being able to do that in practice. So that really drives a lot of what we're doing leading up to the game. The communication piece, that's another one. So making sure that there's things in there that are really building on our communication systems. So again, our athletic therapist, Danielle, is the one that's leading this a lot of the time, as well as Lauren Bushman, who's our sports scientist. And they run the whole warm-up. And there's engagement from a communication standpoint. There's, again, read and react that comes in towards the end of our warm-up to really get the neuromuscular system operating and the mental side, getting them primed and ready to go. And it's not just a physical preparation, but it's mentally as well. So yeah, I mean, we've tried a number of different things. I think we've come to a refinement right now that we're pretty happy with, but yeah, it's certainly been a work in progress and it does take a while to make sure that you're getting that heart rate response that you want, as well as all those other systems to get them firing and ready to go at a high level.
So to give coaches a bit of a picture, it's not traditional layup lines.
No, although there is a small portion where, yeah, they're going full speed layups. Yeah, at the very end, I believe, is when that occurs. There's some communication systems that start where again, our athletic therapist will call out a color of a pylon, let's say, and our athletes are on the end line and they're closing out to that color. And then the people in behind them are reacting to what that first person does and they're closing out to adjacent pylons. So again, really read and react. They're doing skill specific or technically specific items in the warm-up where we're taking pieces out of our offense and we've broken them down into smaller segments where, again, now you've got the interaction of two or three players at a time that are reading and reacting off of what's happening. It's not just rote. It's not just a mindless activity where you can just go out and run around and think you're ready. So really incorporating some of that decision-making into the warm-up as well.
It's great. It's great. And the athletic therapist is on the court the whole time with them. Is that what I understand?
Yeah. Her and Lauren are sports scientists. So yeah, they're out there leading it and helping it run smoothly. We do some, if we have athletes who maybe aren't dressed, who are injured, they could potentially be out there as well. Sometimes they're as passers or they're on the end line. Again, just giving energy and being part of the process and being involved.
And halftime, another one that is often challenged by non-traditional thinkers. What should we be doing for halftime nowadays?
I would love to know the answer to that one.
Isn't it something?
I would say my halftimes are pretty boring. I'm a pretty analytical thinker, so I just kind of want to know what's the problem and how are we going to solve it. And so we'll go in and there might be 2 to 3 things max that we're going to talk about. And again, really solution-based. I don't want to talk about the problem. Like if we can identify what the problem is and how, but the more important thing is how are we going to fix it? As much as we can relate that back to team identity, that will be part of it. And then we're on a tight timeline. We got to make sure the players are back out, I believe at the 6-minute mark so that they can, and this is the other key important piece is the re-warm-up. So the warm-up for the second half, you know, we've had some games where we've had some slow starts in third quarters and then, you know, trying to relate that back to how did we impact that slow start from halftime? You know, where did we take too long getting out of our halftime meeting that they didn't have sufficient time to re-warm up, get that heart rate back up to where it needs to be, or to again be engaging our communication system so that we're maybe not firing on all cylinders when that third quarter starts. So yeah, again, lots of work in progress and we're so fortunate because we do have world-class professionals that are working in this area that are constantly trying to adapt and improve upon how we're running these things.
And that's an advantage that you have access to these world-class professionals. But at the University of Saskatchewan, I know you're well-resourced in a sense relative to Canadian college programs, but you still don't have the perfect situation there in terms of this. Are you applying a lot of these things to the college program in a different way?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the benefits I've been able to enjoy is just being able to take this information and then take it back to the university and college setting. And then how can we adapt it? You know what, we're not going to have the gold medal model like we do with the national team, but you can certainly take the information and the knowledge and apply it to whatever context you have. Yeah, we're not going to have an athletic therapist or sports scientist out there running our warm-up, but how can we take some of the principles of it and adapt it to that setting. And I think you can always do that. And just because you might be short staffed in terms of human resources, I think you can always take the information and then best apply it to whatever context you're in.
No matter what we tried with pregame warm-up, and we tried to do some really, really different things, really focused on shooting as much as anything.
Yes.
But I didn't like watching warm-up. Just no matter what, it's just not enjoyable to watch your players in warm-up, is it?
I can't stand it. If I can be distracted by anyone, that's probably my preference, or maybe watch the other team warm up. But yeah, I would say at the university level, it's a source of my frustration for sure. Again, I'm a perfectionist at heart. So, you know, I want every little thing to be done perfectly. And that's simply not realistic. At the national team level, certainly not as much frustration. You know, we've got some amazing athletes out there running around and doing their thing. And just their level of professionalism and their approach to everything, I think, is always on display. And so it's fun to watch that one for sure.
And I guess where I'm going with there too is that the re-warm up is even worse, right? Coming out of halftime, and that's something that I know coaches will ask. So what are some re-warm-up things? Because I think it's neglected. Like where so many teams just come out. Like I remember my team coming out sometimes and only having 2 balls.
I was like, well, why do we have four balls, six balls, eight balls in pregame? And then when it comes to halftime, we suddenly only have two balls.
That's the opposite one where you've got nine basketballs and nine of them standing, shooting 4 foot shots in the paint, you know, and then getting their own rebound and walking back out to their next shot. Yeah. I think the biggest thing is you have to have a process and you have to have a system and you have to have a routine. And then to be able to do that routine, you have to be able to stick to some tight timelines. And I think, again, your messaging, you can't go on 10-minute diatribes in your halftime talk. You have to be short and succinct and choose your messaging wisely. That the most important message is the one that's getting out there and the one that's getting reinforced so that they remember it going out. And then you're into your re-warm-up routine. And again, the more you can engage and make it a team warm-up as opposed to an individual warm-up. You know, there's certainly going to be individuals, again, at the national team level, you have certain needs and you have some older athletes that maybe have to do something specific for a certain body part to get warmed up. But for the most part, you're playing a team game and you need to warm up that communication system. You have to have interaction between athletes to, again, get that synergy going so it's ready for the third quarter and it can't be individualistic.
And they're not doing layup lines, or what are they doing? I saw a tag as an example.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you actually use that. Maybe that was a theoretical thing. So what are some actual physical things they do when they get back?
Yeah. So again, there will be one speed layup line for a bit, again, just to get the speed going, the speed component. There will be passing. There will be, again, like whether it's not like a small sided game, but it's like it. Sometimes we'll do some two-on-one. And then at the very end, the last thing that we do is the read and react. So it is like a modified game of tag where you have one athlete that starts to move in one direction and the other athlete must react to that. So they have a choice of which direction they go and the other athlete must react. And so you can modify that with two, three, or four athletes at a time. But again, it just gets the neuromuscular system going. And that's the most important piece at the very end, right before you go back out there, is that component.
Your coach, I don't know if you call it a ready sheet, but I know you talked about it having, is your coaches have a sheet for responsibilities in the games, and that extends obviously pregame, in-game, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about the design and the assignment of those?
Yeah. One assistant coach is primarily responsible for the defensive side of the ball. So again, we'll have, or I should say the coach that's responsible for the scout of the team that we're playing will have their stuff on their ready sheet. So their calls, their systems, their sets, what we can expect if there's, you know, late game situation and they need something, you know, do we have that information where we know what they may run? And then about their personnel. So essentially it'll look like our paper scout with some additional information. And then I will always have the offensive stuff. So what our team does, what our team would run in certain scenarios at the end of a game, if it were a tight game. So what we're running on sideline, if we're down two or down three, what we're running in the half court, if we need something for a specific athlete or matchup. Again, just reminders, just to have in front of you so that you don't have to rely on your memory. So just as a bit of a reference sheet. We'll have all of our calls, we'll have all of our baselines, you know, nothing too dramatic there. Where we were a little bit forward thinking, and again, we're test driving some of these things. We're using some of these pre-qualifiers and FIBA Americas to test drive some of these systems just to see what's going to work. So when we get to Tokyo, we've tried a number of things and now we know, okay, this is what we're going with. So our other assistant coach was working on some of these individual identities. So again, that was coming through from our mental performance consultant around individual identities. So we have our team identity, but then each of the individuals will also have, whether it be a cue word or an identity piece that we can reference. So our one assistant would have all those on her reference sheet. So, you know, if we need to connect with a certain athlete, okay, this is how they want to express themselves. How can I relate to them using maybe one of these cue words? So a little bit more on the mental side than anything else. So that was interesting as well to go through that process.
Love it. Love it. Some great things to be able to think about, obviously, with all these different things you're sharing. And the other thing, I know that you mentioned this, or one of your assistants mentioned this, but about you being overly technical as a coach. And I know that's the greatest strength, greatest weakness for me.
Yeah.
I am challenged every day with the same thinking. That I can just solve. I'm a problem solver. You're a problem solver. We can solve it with technical. What are some things that you've learned through that process of knowing yourself and this self-awareness that has helped you overcome the weakness part of that?
Yeah, it really comes from back in the day, 22 years ago, when I first came to the University of Saskatchewan and we weren't very good. And so the thing that I could control was a meticulous preparation and an obsession with the technical tactical, you know, solving problems for the athletes and, you know, finding little weaknesses with the opponent because we weren't very good. We didn't have better athletes or more skilled players, but I thought, you know what, we could just be smarter. And if we're smarter, you can overcome and you can take down some teams that, you know, on paper should be beating you. So that's definitely where it comes from. And I think it's helped us, you know, elevate to a certain level. And even with national team, that's where my default is to really obsess over the technical tactical. However, again, like you said, there's blessings and curses. And the curse side of that is you can sometimes overlook or you can be overly obsessive about those things at the expense of something else. So whether that be just like the simple effort component, connecting with athletes where, you know what, a connection and a relationship with an athlete can overcome any technical or tactical information that you can share with them. So that's probably been my biggest area for growth and the biggest gap where I've been able to develop is just, you know what, like you cannot be so nitpicky about the details. You can't be that perfectionist. There's some bigger issues that you have to attend to that are really going to help your team. So that's where I think more of this attention to the team identity, the mental side in terms of the preparation, the connection with the athletes, just building a stronger connected team, communication with our IST. So trying to solve the problems and in a different way, a little bit more away from the technical tactical piece. Because at the end of the day, when we don't have a ton of time together, you can't be spending so much on that. You really have to be much more of a positive influence and bring more energy and have fun. And really, at the end of the day, that's what I've been trying to do over the past little bit.
I know it's a challenge because I even over the last 10, 15 years where I've moved to this more almost full-time games approach and this understanding of decision-making and the requirement for a player to be a great problem solver, they need to be free to be creative.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for me as a coach. And I know that, but yet I still constantly go back to this technical analytical mind. And I know it drives some people in my life bonkers, but that's how we're wired, right?
Totally. Yeah. It's really tough not to correct everything. And, you know, I used to be one who, well, I can't say used to be because I probably still am, but just constantly stopping things and correcting the littlest details. And like you said, you have to let your players, they have to be the ones that solve the problem and you have to let them play through it. And you have to be okay with some errors and mistakes. You know, we constantly say that's how you learn, is to be able to be forced to problem solve by yourself. If you're spoon fed or told, you certainly don't retain. And those are big lessons, I think, for me and has really helped me in my coaching in the last little bit.
Last thing, which I think is such a key thing from the international game that more and more, I think in the NCAA game, it doesn't apply as much, but it applies almost everywhere else in the world. And that's having a 14-second shot clock plan. Can you talk about that? Because I think you've done some really good stuff with that over the years as well.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, when that first was implemented, we were forced with, okay, what are we doing? And the 14-second reset, yeah, we do not want to run a play. We want, so an offensive rebound, we want to make sure we've got safeties going to specific spots. And what we want is we want a quick, so, you know, potentially on an offensive rebound, you've got the defensive team, you know, in the paint or at least close to the basketball. So we want to expand the D. We want to get the ball back outside the three-point line as quickly as possible if we don't have an easy putback. And then we want to make that next pass. So we want to get the defensive team in scramble. Ideally, we want an open three or we want the ball dumped back in for a duck in for an easy layup. So I think what the stats showed is that we had for specific athletes, the most threes they got were in that scenario off an offensive rebound. It's also going to be the highest percentage shot that you get because of the passing angle and because of your body position, being able to step into that three. So we've really put a lot of value on that and having a plan for that scenario. And it's really paid off.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And again, something that I think coaches need to devote more time to. It's really a special situation.
It is.
Has evolved so much in the game.
Yeah, agreed.
Coach, I cannot thank you enough. tremendous admiration for the coach you are. I am a proud supporter every time I hear of your success with either team you coach, and just tremendous things that you do and you shared so openly with us. So thank you.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much. Yeah, you've done so, so well. And I really appreciate you asking me to be on here. This is a tremendous thing that you do. I listen to your podcast all the time. It's amazing how many people and the amazing coaches that you've had on here. So thank you so much for including me.
Wonderful.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.